The following talk was given by Steve Hagen at Dharma Field Meditation and Learning Center in Minneapolis on October 31, 2004. This talk may not be played or reproduced for profit.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
Well, this morning I want to talk about the traps of Zen, I guess, huh? Maybe Zen without the traps. There's so many traps and snares everywhere, not just in Zen. It's like for most of us, we just sort of walk through life with Velcro on, you know, and just everything is just sticking to us all the time and trying to make our way through. It's pretty difficult. And then when we get into Zen practice, it's right there. It's still going on. Even though Zen is freedom. Zen is about freedom. It's the science of freedom, as it was once described. The knowledge and learning of freedom. So why should there be these traps and snares? Dogen Zenji in the Fukan Zazengi, what he talks about is Zen, this practice that we do. Once its heart is grasped, you know, you're like the tiger as she enters the mountain, the dragon when he enters the water. And he said, traps and snares can never reach it. So if traps and snares can never reach it, why do we seem to get trapped and snared? So I want to look at that today. And actually, what got me thinking about what it is I want to say today was in digging in this little book, which Jim has brought us to in his class, which is just wrapping up. You've missed a great class, by the way, on the 10 bowls that Jim has been teaching his last 6 weeks now. Just ending tomorrow night now. But we've been using this book here, Zen Flesh, Zen Bones, yes. My original copy totally disintegrated, so eventually I got a fresh book here. But this is a great little book. I haven't really looked at it much lately. Anyway, in picking it up again and looking it through, I was kind of looking at some of the other stories that are in here. And I came upon this one that really spoke to me and got me thinking about right where we're at right now, right here. I'll just read a portion of it. It says, in modern times, a great deal, yeah, I should say this too, that a lot of the stories in here are from more recent times. We have the Mumon Khan, which is a collection of koans from centuries ago. And the Ten Bulls, that was from, what is that? 13th century. Yeah, so it's a while back. A lot of these. But some of these other stories in the front, 101 Zen stories, are from more modern times. So you could have anything from almost current events, not quite, all the way back to the ancient masters, to the time of the Buddha, in these stories. Anyway, in this one, he says, in modern times, a great deal of nonsense is talked about masters and disciples and about the inheritance of a master's teaching by favorite pupils, entitling them to pass the truth on to their adherents. Of course, Zen should be imparted in this way, from heart to heart, and in the past it was really accomplished. Silence and humility reigned, rather than profession and assertion. The one who received such a teaching kept the matter hidden, even after 20 years. Not until discovered through his own need that a real master was at hand, was it learned that the teaching had been imparted. And even then, the occasion rose quite naturally, and the teaching made its way in its own right. Under no circumstance did the teacher ever claim, I am the successor of so-and-so. Such a claim would prove quite the contrary. Interesting. This is just a little introduction to the piece, to the story, which I won't get into. But I thought there's a lot there that we can look at today. This is in modern times, a great deal of nonsense is talked about masters and disciples and about the inheritance of the master's teaching. Yeah, there's talk about traps and snares and snags and Velcro. Where is this coming from? It's coming from our own minds, our own thinking, and our grasping, and we talk. We talk about this, we talk about that, we speculate on this and that. And who will be the teacher's successor, or things of this sort. It gets talked about. And what happens when we do that? Pretty soon, it seems like maybe in our own mind, we're thinking that the Sangha, the group of practitioners, are being divided up in some way. And then pretty soon now we have the sheep and the goats, right? And then we want to know, well, who's who here? And what kind of a pecking order do we have? But this is all coming from our thinking and speculating and talking. And pretty soon jealousies arise and envy and resentment. In one of the classes a while back, somebody made the observation that resentment comes from unfulfilled expectations. What are we expecting? If you truly aren't expecting anything, what is there to get upset over? What is there to grasp? And if you're concerned, you're speculating on this or that or who, or is it me, or you know, what are you doing? And what's going on in your own mind, in your own practice? Because this is what it comes down to. And if you're concerned about somebody else who might be getting some recognition or this or that or whatever, you know, you start putting on these outfits and going through all these different kinds of things that we inherited, ordinations and lay ordinations and priest ordination and all of this kind of stuff. And we're wondering, well, who are these people and why them? And it's just all this stuff gets stirred up. And it's kind of like this is a way of just stirring up something that really ought to be left simple, plain, undisturbed. A place where we can come and just leave all that kind of thinking, that kind of grasping behind. Because when we come here, we should at least be reminded or try to remind ourselves that this is different than that. This is different than the world of getting and spending and grasping and getting a license or a certificate or one thing or another. That just really disturbs us in all kinds of ways. You feel like, well, I could never be one of those, and we feel kind of left out maybe. Or somebody else seems to be just moving ahead and getting acknowledged, and boy, maybe we should go worship that person. Or maybe I'm a little resentful of that because I don't think that person deserves what? What have they gotten? We forget that we're told over and over again to look at your own mind, to realize that the teacher never gives anything, never hands out anything, not really. Oh, there's priest ordination, there's this or that. You can get a certificate or two for one thing or another. But this is about freedom from that. It causes so much trouble and it takes us away from what this practice and teaching is really all about. That we learn to observe just our own mind, our own heart, and what is going on here. And it doesn't matter that somebody now can wear a hat and this person, you know, gets golden shoes or whatever it is, I don't know. What has that got to do with you and your mind? You see somebody come by with a hat, and are you watching the hat and thinking about that person, or are you observing your own mind? And I'll tell you this, that a wise teacher, one who sees what's going on, is that they're watching all of this. And if there's a true teacher at hand, they're not paying any attention to the certificate or the this or the that. They are looking to see if there's any spark of understanding, any maturity in the practice, that one isn't constantly just knocked around this way and that. When you encounter someone who appears to have been granted something or other, that just doesn't even faze you. But I don't think we needlessly need to drag in things to test people, because the world itself supplies enough of that. Nevertheless, I'll take the blame for all of this. We have dragged in a few things here. I eliminated an awful lot, more than you probably could realize. But there's still some left behind here. And maybe it's time to just abandon it all. But he said that, he goes on here, he says that, we speculate about the inheritance of teachers, you know, the favorite students and all this kind of stuff, and who's entitled to pass on the truth, etc. He says, of course, Zen should be transmitted in this way from heart to heart. And in the past, it was really accomplished. Silence and humility reigned, rather than profession and assertion. That since this work is really going on within our own heart and mind, for each one of us as an individual, it is going on silently. It isn't broadcast everywhere. On the surface, all kinds of things are happening. Awards are being dished out, and one thing or another is happening. But the actual practice, like it says in the Song of Jewel Mirror Awareness, it ends up as a practice like a fool, like an idiot. Just working within. So this is called the host within the host. Most of us end up being the host for the guest, where our attention is always out there. We're not paying attention to just settling into our true nature, which is just right here, and just seeing what that is and seeing what it is that we are doing right here. But it is in this way that the practice matures within a person, and that we can eventually come to realize the truth ourselves in this moment, in what we do, in what we're picking up, and what we're setting down. So I've been concerned about this, because, you know, I saw right from the very, very start, I thought perhaps we could do this a little differently. Well, as I mentioned, we have done it quite differently from all of the training I got, especially the kind of training I got in Japan, where it was really heavily loaded with the ceremony and the liturgy, all that sort of thing. And it struck me as being kind of dangerous. Dangerous sort of thing, because like you said, in ancient times, these transmissions would go on silently. Teaching goes on silently. Well, I'll tell you, ancient times are not. That's the only way it goes on. It goes on silently, and right there within your own mind. And maybe some recognition with a teacher is occurring at some point. But this is your business. It's not a public thing. And so what is going on the surface, on the public, on the level, you know, where everyone can see this or that, a lot of stuff can go on there. And I thought by removing much of it, well, much of it just didn't really fit at all anyway, for a number of reasons, which I've spoken of before. But I felt we always needed a certain form. And I did want to acknowledge some individuals who I felt that maybe with a sincere heart they said that they want to devote themselves to this practice. But I realize now that this should never be made public, because it really is a matter of what's going on within your own heart and mind. And it just causes trouble, disturbs people, creates the illusion that there's such a thing as, you know, the sheep and the goats, that kind of stuff. So I think it's something that we need to watch for here, because it is so easy. Zen is a very powerful kind of practice. It really reaches us on a very deep level. And some of these things can really get in there and disturb us in very profound ways. So I think we need to be careful of this, because if we don't do this, like Zen itself is actually very pure. It doesn't really have any color or stuff of its own. It doesn't even have its own literature, really. You got these stories and things, but it doesn't even have its own sutras. It's just practice. And then there's stories, accounts, historical events that have happened. There's little teaching things that get inserted into those. But it basically doesn't have much. But along the way, us being human beings, of course, with all this Velcro and sticky stuff all around us, pretty soon we're picking up things, you know. And so eventually Zen gets kind of cluttered. And this original transmission that goes on quietly, and the practice that goes on quietly, pretty soon starts to look like it's being acknowledged in various ways. People arriving at various stations, it begins to look like the rest of the world. And the same kind of stuff starts coming up. And then we can have Zen that's kind of devoted to a lot of, we'll say, the liturgy or the ceremony and that sort of thing. Well, there's always a downside to it. I mean, that might be wonderful because you can really put yourself into the ceremony and you can kind of lose yourself and, you know, and in the chanting and that. You can almost like get into a trance. But of course, if we really understand this meditation that we do, it's not about going into a trance or losing yourself in that way and just turning yourself over to something else, like the beat and the rhythm and the show. You know, so there's a downside that to the devotional kinds of practice, we can end up turning into just kind of a superstition. How about just the practice itself? We really devote ourselves to Zazen. You know, we get a lot of that in our school. But pretty soon the Zazen becomes kind of macho and kind of militaristic and push. And the sessions can get longer and longer. In fact, I heard of some monks that got together one time. They wanted to do 100-day session. Why? Why would you do that? Sessions is about quantity? Or is it about just taking some time where you're not distracted by a number of things and you just quietly watch your mind? You know, so downside to all these, we study the literature, get into the intellectual aspects of all the philosophy, but at some point it just becomes kind of empty, and I don't mean empty in the Nagarjunian sense, but just devoid of anything that's really helped. Any real true understanding comes from that, because just that intellectual endeavor alone leaves you without a real understanding that you have to work that through in your practice. You see, so what is it? Is it then the practice? I mean, that becomes too much, or do we think about it a lot? It's always fun to come and talk about things and sit down and discuss and read the books. Or we get into the psychology of Zen, you see. And if we're not careful there, a downside there. Everything's got a downside. A downside, we get kind of narcissistic. You know, we get fixed on the self in various ways, even if it means that we're fixed on ourselves in ways that this is about freeing ourselves of ego and that sort of thing. Well, I don't think it works that way. Very easily, pretty soon, we begin to, because we're dealing with, begin to form something there. And the actual psychology of Buddhism came out of a deep understanding that we actually don't even find this thing. And yes, we do pay attention, maybe observe the thoughts and feelings that are coming up. But pretty soon we start making systems there and we begin to grasp one thing or another, and then this stuff begins to build, and pretty soon we're caught once again. And we're not free of the self, we have formed the self. We get into the psychology with the understanding that somehow I want to straighten myself out and improve myself in some way. Well, this just isn't freedom. This is the same old bondage that we've suffered from all along. So, it's like anything that we pick up, you know, it has this downside to it. We have to understand that. But this isn't about picking up anything or getting anything, a certificate or anything at all. And a true teacher isn't going to try to hand you anything or sell you anything. The role of the teacher is nothing more than just pointing out a few things to you, And we need to have the subtleties of the things that need to be pointed out are profound. And it needs to be pointed out to us again and again and again. Until you've heard things over and over and over again. And you, where our minds glaze over, yeah, I know, okay, I know that. And then just keep going, because you might discover in another 10, 15 years that, you know, I didn't understand that. Certainly was my experience. Things that I thought I knew, oh, yeah, I know that. You come back, just like coming back to this little story. If I had read this before I started ordaining people, I might have stopped. When there was still some time before I could do a lot of damage. I just want to say that in its heart, Zen truly is about freedom. And it really is about, you know, you've heard this before, but it is about not getting hold of anything. It is about learning to, with the most honest mind you can muster in this moment, just learning to sit there and see what is going on with you, right here. And in this way, we can awaken from our delusion, from our confusion, awaken from that grasping mind that is operating on the base assumption that we think we can actually get hold of something. Ourselves or something else, improve ourselves, or to finally at long last see what this is. And this doesn't take a whole lot. Daily practice is very good. I think we should keep that. And classes, learning these subtle teachings are very good. I think we should keep that. Having talks like this that help us just bring us back to this again and again. Even if you've heard it, you need to come back to it. I think that is very, very good, very helpful in kind of removing the clutter from the path. We get a better sense of just what this is that we're taking up here, what it is that we really want to come to, which is freedom. Freedom from our own suffering and confusion. So there's a few things like this that I think we just simply need. But I think we can get rid of the excess form, the form of outfits and ordinations and things like that. And I've been toning this back a bit. And I've been talking with Norm, who will be joining us soon on a regular daily basis. Norm Roshi. And we were talking about this the other night. We went out, had pizza, and then talked about this. Afterward, I was driving home in the car, and then he said, oh, there's one more thing, he said. And it was just the one item that I had left out, this business about Roshi. Yeah, he doesn't want it. And I told him, I said, well, you know, in about a year, I'm going to turn 60. And I told you guys that you could call him Roshi when he was 60. And I said, I realized that probably in a year, they're going to start calling me Roshi. And I was thinking, you know, at that time, you know, I don't think I want that. Norm doesn't want it. And I think he even sends it. My name is Steve. Why don't you just call me Steve now? There are reasons I've discussed, reasons why I thought maybe we should go with that, just in ways of respecting the teaching and the tradition. But I don't know. It's just one more of those things that pretty soon we catch on to. You see? There might have been a time in my life when, oh, geez, boy, that'd be neat if you ever got to be a Roshi, you know. But I don't feel that way now. And if I did, well, I feel sorry for you if I did. But I don't. But why even create a situation where that possibility is there? So I think little by little we can just, pare back on these things. The ones that I have ordained, I told them last summer that I don't want to be going with this setting the priests apart and separate as if it were something. When, what does it mean? I thought it meant that you would devote your life to the practice. And it's easily said, easily done. We slap on some robes and things, but it's another thing to actually do it. if somebody has that in their heart, I'll see that. It can show up in all kinds of ways. It doesn't even necessarily mean that you'll be here all the time, but I would expect to see you. But I know some of you can't get here all the time. You practice at home. But you can always come in and talk to me about that. This teaching goes on in kind of a little bit more personal way. If you want to include me in your practice in that way, you can always come and talk to me. That's why we have the Dokusan out here. And you're all welcome. You don't have to be a member of Dharma Field. It has nothing to do with Dharma Field in that sense. It's just you. If you want to talk to me about some of that, you can. I'm looking for those things that just snag us and cause blocks and trouble and jealousies and pettiness and confusion and, oh, who's going to be the Dharma heir and all this kind of stuff. And people telling me that they got it figured out, who's my Dharma heir? Well, let me know, would you? I haven't figured that out. You're reading some crystal ball in the future? How do we even know I'll have a Dharma heir? What's to say I couldn't have 10? Pay attention to your business. This will go on quietly now, because I'm not going to hold anybody up with the appearance of something or other. Well, maybe after what I've said, you have something you want to say, so I'll pause right now. Any questions, though, about anything I've said? Yeah, Matt.
Can you just say a little bit about what Dharma Air is and how that works in the past?
Yeah, well, Dharma Air, a true Dharma Air. See, what has happened to the whole Dharma transmission stuff is bogus. I've said it on a number of occasions. I hope you recall that. It was where you get the brown robe, and in our school, that's what this means. But the whole ceremony and faldera and everything that was all around that, it's all bogus. They even brought in a crew of people from Japan, and some of the stuff that we went through, there are certain stages you have to go through, and so we training stages, but we just staged it and they took pictures of it. And then there's some other things that where you're supposed to explain certain things. That was the original how it was. You should be able to explain this to your teacher, something or other. Well, they had it explained to us. So Dharma transmission doesn't mean anything. And I've said this before. I'm probably saying a little bit more than I have in the past, because I felt some need to maybe, what? I don't know, protect it or something? I don't know what. But that's bogus. I will tell you this, that anything that looks like something that stands up and has got some certificate and the banner and everything, I wouldn't pay any attention to it. Now, I don't mean to say then that that's false, or that the person who happens to have this banner or this whatever is false. It doesn't mean that either. It means you just can't tell. Or you look at the people that don't have such and such. You still can't tell. At least not from anything on the superficial side of it. Because it just isn't there. What things look like on the surface is just not it. So real transmission, well, I'm getting to your question. So real transmission then is, it's what is going on in the heart and in the mind and in reality with the understanding of this. And if a teacher recognizes this with someone, it's a one-to-one kind of thing going on between a student and a teacher. And that's why, like he said, it used to go on just secretly. And sometimes the guy go on 20 years before anybody ever found out. Or maybe never. I'm sure there are plenty of cases of that as well. Yeah.
Is that what Dorian talks about? Face-to-face transmission?
Yes. Right. Face-to-face transmission. And that's what it is. And it's a private thing between a student and a teacher. And it's not public.
It's spoken?
Not necessarily. No, the actual transmission is not spoken, no. And another thing, transmission isn't a word. It isn't transmitted. Nothing is transmitted. This is very important to understand. Because if you think that, then you might think that, well, say if you viewed me as your teacher or something like that, then you might think that I've got something to transmit. Or maybe it's something, maybe he'll transmit that to me. You know, see, that's what's wrong with that word. It's because it just simply doesn't work that way. The teacher doesn't really give you anything. Well, they may be give you whatever we give you, it's all that superficial stuff. That's why you don't pay too much attention to that. On the other hand, as my teacher used to say, don't ignore that either, because you know sometimes we need that. Though I don't think we need it as much as maybe he thought, but he cut back quite a bit, you know, and I'm grateful for that. But I think we can go even further with it. But anyway, but he used the example of, like, for example, if you go into the barber, for men anyway, pictured in the old days when they had that straight edge razor, just a long blade, you know, and you go into the barber, you know, and then he says, and you throw your neck back and he's going to shave your throat. Why would you try? You walk into this shop and you're going to trust some guy with a blade like that right here? Why do you do that? Well, he's put this little certificate on the wall. He's got his license from the city to do that, you see. So he says it kind of, you know. So even though it's all going on in the world of the surface, you know, and there's something to that. But the fact is that the real transmission is something that's going on heart to heart. Because there is this matter of seeing. And if one who sees recognizes that, and that's called transmission, but that other who sees, finally, at long last, who wakes up, nothing was transmitted. We're already in enlightenment from the start, but finally it's recognized. They see it. And somebody else realizes that you do. That's called transmission. So it's not a matter of something being handed off. Also, to hang around with someone who sees, very helpful for you to see. Because if you're just off wandering around by yourself, there's a lot of confusion out there, a lot of disturbance, a lot of influences by deluded people. They abound everywhere. So you might want to be careful about that. Very, very good. If you can find someone who sees, that's very good to be around such a person like that. If you can find someone who's not confused, who's not ultimately confused, very helpful for you. Yeah. We all get caught in bits of confusion from time to time. And that's another thing too. People think that our practice is about once you learn this, now you can just walk a perfect straight line and never stumble, never fall. No, it doesn't mean that at all. Our practice is, you know, because you're a human being, of course you can stumble. You can stumble like anybody can stumble. But this practice is, how quickly can you get back up and start walking again? And that's really what it comes down to. Because if you understand the nature of the world and you're not tossed away momentarily, yeah, we can get cut because we're always walking with Velcro on, you know. But the moment you notice that you've been hooked, how quickly can you free yourself? And if you have real understanding, you should be able to do that in short order. And so you can get back up and walk. But don't ever expect perfection from another, because you're going to injure yourself by thinking that. Because you'll never find that good friend that you need, you know, who's not confused. So, did that help you, Matt, or did you have another? Yeah. Yes?
You have me wondering about the role of rituals, and I think that's a little bit about what you're talking about.
Yeah. Yeah, I think some people do. I don't think that we all do. But on the other hand, there's plenty of ritual. Like just getting up in the morning and brushing your teeth and, you know, just all the different things that we do during the day. Why not just do what you do? Do it in the most ordinary way, but just focus your mind on that. We'll make some special kind of ritual, you know. And it's amazing how these things creep in, you know, like one of the instruments that you have to learn when you go through Dharma transmission, you see, you get these different things, you know, and one of them is the whisk, you know, that fly whisk. Believe it or not, it's an instrument that you use in certain ways, you know. I was instructed on that all, you know. Where did this come from? Well, you know, I can imagine at some point in the history of Zen, there was probably some place where they had flies. And the master, you know, sitting there and he's giving a talk and he's got the fly whisk and every once in a while he just maybe picks it up or whatever. But at some point it probably gets incorporated into the proceedings there somewhere, you see. And then something else gets added in, something else gets added in, something else. And then we've long since forgotten where did this ever get started. And it becomes part of the ritual. And at some point it starts to become just so much clutter. And then we have a lot of ideas embedded in that that come up from who knows. We make up stories and explanations, and then we say, well, this makes me feel good. I really feel good wielding that whisk. Or the one that was really neat was the chapeau, which is kind of a martial arts instrument, stylized kind of thing that you can really whack people with. And that was, or the shukin, you know, you get this silk rope that you wear around your waist, and you can really snap people, you know, 12 feet from you. Boom, you know. It's really great, you know. But, you know, you think, man, I really want to learn how to whip that thing, you know. So we can get caught up in stuff like this, you see. And that's fine. I think for someone who, if you want to do that, if you really want to take up the ritual, you want to learn some art or, you know, flower arranging or something like that, for the mental discipline of it and the beauty of it, that's perfectly fine. But there are some real snares there and traps. And that's all I'm warning. I'm not saying that you shouldn't involve yourself with things like this, ritual or whatever. If you want to, if you like that, you know, you want to do that, why not? Just go ahead. But I would say at that point, just be very careful. Understand what it is you're doing and why you're doing it. See if you're caught on one thing or another. So I'm not saying not to do that, but I'm just saying there's some real traps there. The other thing I'm saying is that because there are all these traps, and I know maybe it won't catch you, but it could catch other people. And it catches us in various ways. Sometimes we fall in love with it, and oh, man, that's so, I felt so great when I saw that. That was so. Or we're turned off by it, just repelled by it. You know, if we had the Buddha statue here, just repelled. Maybe some people are even repelled by the stone, I don't know. Because you get to a point where you got to do something. But it's a matter of just keeping it very simple. So here, what I'm saying here, I really want to minimize this. And I think we've gone a bit too far. One of the things, too, that Katagiri Roshi told me was that, and he realized I probably would be doing some teaching at some point. And he said, you have to find your own way. He said, I'm Japanese, I can only show you what I've learned, and that's what I learned. But you have to find your own way. He even said, you know, he mentioned specifically your own way to dress, the kind of outfits we would wear, whatever, as well as the kind of ritual and things like this that we would do. You have to find your own way, because he realized you couldn't just import it from Japan and plunk it down here. When I was in Japan, I discovered that I'd say half of the stuff that we were doing was Shinto in origin. That I discovered after I'd gone to a few Shinto ceremonies really surprised me. So why, you know, here I am, why am I learning this? No, it didn't make sense. And it isn't that was bad, it was beautiful in many ways. But why would I learn that, and why would I bring that back to Minnesota? It doesn't make any sense, you see. But even if I did and people want to take it up, then that's fine. But I would just say to anyone, just be careful. Know your own heart and mind as you engage in this practice or that ritual or whatever it is you're doing. Because this is about being free. Can we engage in such a ritual as that, free and unimpeded in our mind? Yeah, I think you can. But it's very difficult. Why load on any extra? When our whole day, in fact, is, in a sense, provides us with plenty of ritual, just in the regular mundane routine things that we do. That as we approach our car in the morning, that we mindfully take out the keys, whatever, or the little beep thing that we have, and you know. But you know, everything that we do in that way. In some places where they'll pause, you say a gata of rest before you answer the phone. Say, yeah. What about if we just answer the phone with mindfulness? Then you just always do that. So my feeling is just to pare it down, to get to the core of what it is that we're trying to do here with that. And don't put anything extra on it. That's what I would say. That's what I would teach. That's what I want to set up here. Minimal clutter. But other places that have it, that's fine. Go to it. If you really want it, I would say go down and see my Dharma brother down there in Iowa. He has it. About as much as you're going to find anywhere, especially here in the Midwest, certainly. My brother Shulkin, and I love him, and he's, you know, we're good buddies. And he knows how I feel about these things. But I don't condemn him and his practice and what he's doing. And I think for anyone who wants it, I would even tell you, yes, please, there's a good place to go to study that. But here, I'm not going to do that. I would also say there's plenty of places that have that to a greater or lesser degree. Very few that have parsed it away to almost nothing. We can't actually parse it down to nothing because we have to do something, you see. But anyway, that's where we are. I want to clear that up because I have made some moves now to even make it more simple. So, well, we probably have gone over, huh? What? No?
7 minutes.
7 minutes? Not that there's a magic time here. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. To hear more talks on Buddhism, Zen, and related topics, visit dharmafield.org.